Yeah, things just timed out well for VCFA. After about 2 days of just sort of looking around at the students there, looking at some of the work, I realized that it was a very special place. And to the point where I'm like, I pulled Steve. I'm like, I don't think you guys realize what a special thing you have going here. Mm-hmm. When I was at VCFA, I found my voice, and I think my voice is, there's always some loss involved, and I'm okay with that.
So that's nice, a great ad for VCFA right now. Go to the Vermont College of Fine Arts Film Program and find your voice as a filmmaker.
Find your voice. Yeah, I mean, I did, and that was I thought I had it figured out before I went there. Like, so before I went to VCFA.
This is James Mason, and you're listening to Filmwax Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Chartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio. It's Thursday, May 16th, 2019. This is episode number 553 of the podcast. I welcome you to the show. Of course, that was me. What you think of my James Mason impression, but I decided to pull it out. As today, as I record this, is actually Wednesday. I'm recording this on Wednesday, the 15th of May, and this is James Mason's birthday. He was born in 1909. So had he been alive today, he'd be 110 years old. It could happen. If you've never seen him in movies like A Star is Born, Bigger Than Life, North by Northwest, Lolita, The Verdict, Heaven Can Wait, so many, many, many other films. But those are some of my favorites. Anyway, over the years, I've had an ongoing relationship with the Vermont College Fine Arts Film Program, and I'm proud to say we are about to start something a little bit new, which is going to be a series of episodes coming up over the spring with some of the film school alumni, and we're going to talk to them and find out what's going on with them. I'm really behind this program. It's very unique. I don't know if there's any other film programs that take this particular tact. The Vermont College of Fine Art MFA in Film offers a 2-year student design, project-driven graduate program of professional mentorships for your scripts, fiction and nonfiction filmmaking, and hybrid and transmedia projects. Exciting, affordable, and intense, refine your creative vision as you develop intensely personal stories in an independent practice. So each semester begins with an on-campus residency week of screenings and workshops, lectures, and crits, along with preparation of an independent study plan of your own personal projects. Then students and faculty return home to work independently and meet monthly via Skype as their projects unfold. So the MFA program is essentially designed to fit into the life you have and the films you make. I visited several years ago for one of the residencies, and I had a really amazing time. That episode, by the way, was the episode 348, and I had on a number of filmmakers, students who were there making films, so you can go back and check out that episode, number 348, if you want a little bit more information. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk to George Nicholas, who is a filmmaker as well as a teacher. He teaches cinematography and film production up at Hofstra, and he lives just north of New York City. We had this conversation a couple of weeks ago. We had a very nice time talking, so I'm looking forward to you hearing this, and we're going to have a couple of more episodes like this coming up in the coming months. So check out the Vermont College of Fine Arts. It's vcfa.edu/film, and you can check out that. And if you do contact the Vermont College of Fine Arts, please do mention you heard about it here on Filmwax Radio. In the meantime, this is George Nicholas. He's a director, a producer, and a cinematographer, and I was very pleased to meet him, and this is our conversation here on Filmwax Radio.
Mm-hmm.
rest of the international film festival circuit from the last year.
Sure.
And the other categories, you know, a few handful of premieres, you know, which are generally Hollywood or, you know, larger budget films. So they stopped taking submissions because they just felt like it was a scam that they were, you know, why take people's money if they have no intention of considering the film in any real sense.
What's the thing about festivals? I mean, there's so many of them. And so you could spend thousands and thousands of dollars submitting.
Sure. Well, that's why I think many people end up trying to pull whatever connections they can to you know, get waived fees.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, with Antigone particularly, I had to, you know, I had a lot of success with that film, but, you know, part of it was twofold. One, I made it a point not to submit to any place that hadn't been around for at least 10 years. You know, for no particular reason, just kind of wanted festivals that maybe people had heard of. But another thing was sort of, it's a hard film to program, you know, it's like, how do you, because I think about, you know, like running times. I made a film or shot a film. That's primarily what I do is I'm a DP. So the first film that I did with this director, Gabriel Jude Weinshill, who I've made a bunch of films for, we actually have a feature that Gabriel Jude Weinshill.
Oh, sure. Seven
Splinters in Time.
Splinters of Time, which I watched as well.
Oh, cool. So our first film was a thing called The Broken Wings of Elijah Footfalls. And that was 45 minutes long with about 8 lines of dialogue in it. So it's a stupid running time. If you know festivals, like it's 45 minutes is a really ridiculously stupid running
time.
It's
difficult for anything. I mean, broadcast.
Absolutely. I mean, when I was in film school, you know, way back when, you know, it was at Purchase, you know, I think back then, even the shorts were your target time was like a TV half, like 22.5 or something. So, and that's changed. I mean, now I think your ideal time for a short is about 9 minutes, you know, 9 to 12 minutes, I think. That said, it's like, where in a program do you put, you know, this very personal experimental documentary about someone's dead mom, you know, and that was the tricky thing. And it was interesting that the festivals that I got into was very interesting, like what ones picked it up, you know, first, I think. And, you know, when you're nominated for something, you go, right? That's just the thing. So I wasn't going to go. I kind of, you know, selfishly sort of apply to festivals in places I wanted to visit. You know, so there was that.
That's an interesting strategy. It's as legitimate as any other.
Yeah. I mean, so, and so the Cary Film Festival, which has a really big short, they're a shorts festival. They do feature, they program features, but they're not in competition. So they had reached out to me and said that it had been nominated for Best Documentary. So I went there. And when I got there, I understood, like, there a lot of the films in, not necessarily in my block, just sort of in general, were kind of sad in that way that The Irish can be profoundly sad. So that was, you know, sort of found a home there, which is kind of nice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Except with Splinters, we had the same problem. I mean, we were all over the place with that. We finally found a home amongst the smart nerds in at Cinequest last year. So that was was nice. That was it's also finding people that get your film. I mean, not so much Antigone. I think everybody kind of gets that. It's sort of one of the reasons I made it. But something like Seven Splinters is a very hard film. It doesn't really. It's not what people expect, and if you look at our IMDb, it's about 3.3, and people either love it or hate it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, they mostly hate it because it wasn't what they expected. So,
I think science fiction people are used to a particular way of telling a science fiction story, but there are a handful of films that fall under this genre that are more experimental and abstract in their approach. Now, of course, I'm struggling to remember this guy's name who did.
It was like the guys who did Primary. And
yeah,
like
Primer.
Primer.
Yeah, you got
color,
it. Yeah,
yeah.
He's a Texas filmmaker. Yeah, I'd say that he's coming kind of from a similar direction. But anyway, I have relationships with both Austin and Lynn Cohen, so I kind of was also another motivation.
Oh, brilliant.
For seeing. Yeah,
Lynn was. They were both phenomenal, and Lynn
Lynn
was amazing. We had her, I think we may have had her for a day. I mean, mm-hmm. It might have been 2 days, but I think it was a day. And we had a shot, just one shot that we needed of her waking up Darius. And there was no way we were going to hump her out to Long Island to shoot in the studio. So in her apartment, which we'd redressed and, you know, changed for the days or whatever, we had brought in a sort of, you know, the art department had built sort of a ceiling, right, mm-hmm. that we could put over. And it was essentially me lying on my back with this like 40 pounds worth of Red camera balanced on my face, like literally on my face. And, you know, and she was leaning over into
yes,
it.
Yes, I remember
and,
that.
And waking him up. And then right after, she was like, dogpile, and like had the whole crew dogpile, which is very funny.
Really?
She was just, yeah, she was just wonderful.
She doesn't know what her age is. That's her problem and her solution.
It's not a problem.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's a delightfully it wonderful
is.
Thing.
No, she was timeless. She could be like sexy and she just doesn't care what it's printed on the page. She, as far as her age goes, she doesn't care about that. It doesn't apply
And the audience, the test audiences particularly responded. I mean, that was one of the clear things they responded to very well was Lynn's character.
Yeah, I understand. Her scenes were much more straightforward. Let's put it that way. You know, just more kind of conventional in a story or a narrative sense. Unlike Austin, who... So also, though, still approached it with the same kind of humor that Lynn did in her scene. So, yeah, I haven't seen her in a little while, but we were friendly for a while. But Austin did my podcast recently, and actually just when I saw him, it reminded me to contact him because we had talked about doing a part two.
Oh, cool. Austin is a force, right? I mean, he's just kind of like, always there. He's like, I watched Catch 20. So I missed reading Catch 22. It's one of those books that sort of went past me. So I read it much later in life, right?
Okay.
And then recently, you know, within the past couple of years, I watched the film. And, you know, and there he was in the film looking like.
Did you talk to him about the way Orson Welles treated Mike Nichols on the set?
No, but I'm trying to imagine how that went.
Not well. Depends who you talk to, you know, but Orson really beat up on Mike Nichols. And Mike Nichols. You know, considering how young he was at the time, took it quite well. He pushed back or managed to do the job regardless. But Orson Welles tried to do a power play, essentially, you know.
And that had to be like fairly late in Orson's career as well. I mean, I sometimes feel
I think
how
he was.
How do you follow? You know, how do you follow Kane? Like, it's all downhill from that, right?
It didn't have to be.
It didn't have to be, but I mean, it's just sort of like peaking in high school, right?
Right.
So you don't, I think as much as you want success, you don't ever want your first success to be so, you know.
Right,
so,
and the best not, film ever time, made, a, or at least in this country. Right, and I think that's a heavy burden.
I mean, the one thing I've always, given, well, and Welles is a genius, but the one thing I've always given is just the sheer balls of making that film.
Mm-hmm.
Not just for the scale of it, of just you know, taking that very intimate detail that became, you know, the mystery of the film, taking that very intimate detail and just sort of shoving it in the face of, you know, just shoving it in his face is insane.
You know? As a cinematographer, do you draw a distinction between, let's say, classic Hollywood cinematographers like Greg Tolan, for instance, who, since we're talking about Citizen Kane, who also worked for John Ford and many other directors, but or are you more influenced more by more contemporary cinematographers, or do you make no distinction?
I don't make a distinction because I think it just depends on the story they're telling. I mean, one of the best, you know, I think one of the best compliments I ever got in my work is one of the first, I think maybe in the first film I shot for someone else, and she was sort of a former student, and she called me, you know, my students, when they leave me, they never leave. Right. So I'll get phone calls. And it was a student who, had made good films when she was at Sarah Lawrence. I was Sarah Lawrence at the time. And, she was freaking out. She just needed to know what kind of batteries to get for her camera. So her father had like bought her a very nice ish camera. Right. And, so we started talking and then she started freaking out that her DP had basically made this giant list of equipment that he wanted. And it was a Kurt Vonnegut story, Next Door. I guess it was not Upstairs, I think. I forgot what it was called, but it was basically, you know, kids left alone and there's some sketchy things happening next, you know, in the next apartment and while his parents are out and he sort of witnesses all of this stuff or hears all this stuff. And, you know, she had rented an apartment. She was very smart about it. She rented an apartment in Brooklyn that was up for sale and then had, you know, her production designer went down to Pennsylvania and got all this furniture and dressed the place, but her DP hadn't visited set yet. And then she's kind of freaking out about how, you know, sort of involved he was. So I stepped in, you know, she asked me to shoot and I said, sure, it'd be fun. And I went in and I shot it and And it was black and white. It was like black and white reversal. It was a period piece. So it was kind of a chance to shoot it the way I did, but, you know, no one was getting paid, whatever. And, you know, when they were in the session, the colorist said, this work reminds me of Tolan's. And I wasn't there, so it wasn't like he was trying to, like, stroke my ego. So she relayed that back to me, and I was just like, that's not a bad person to be compared to.
It's you're in a difficult position because, you know, maybe you're being stroked at the same time.
In the room, it would have been a different thing. But yeah, having heard it from, you know, heard it come back, it was kind of nice.
Oh, I see. Very good.
No, yeah. I wasn't there. I wasn't there for color. I mean, the whole post in that thing was a nightmare because we had, you know, it was a digital, it was a film Bolex, right? We were shooting 16mm. And it had a crystal sync motor on it, and they were taking sound, but the sound person wasn't quite sure what they were doing. It's a loud camera. So most of the shots, you know, that were sync, I had moving blankets over my head and leather jackets over my head. It was like 100 degrees outside. And we had, you know, an air conditioner that we would bring in between takes, but of course you couldn't run it during the takes.
Right.
It was so hot that the emulsion was sticking to itself, you know, inside the magazine. So, so after all of that, the sound wasn't good and they had to ADR the entire thing twice because the desk crashed the first time. So
nightmares in filmmaking.
It's all so hard. I'm surprised anyone does it.
So what years were you a student at the Vermont College of Fine Arts? What years did you go through their film program?
Right. So, I started, I think, in 2016 in the spring.
Okay. Very recent.
Yeah. So very recent. Yeah. I would say a recent graduate. I'm still actually finishing my thesis. Because the success of two films that I made, their shorts, and the release of our feature film, it came, you know, it sort of hit during, I just found there was, I think it was last spring. It was last spring. I found myself, every time I had a deadline, I was in another country or state trying to write, while having to go to premieres and stuff. So, I mean, it's not a bad place to be in, but, I had written a short for my thesis and sort of made sort of two thesis quality, you know, things when I was there, but I'd written a short for my thesis and realized that it really needed to be a feature. So started developing that into a feature, which became kind of epic in scale. So, I've been trimming that back, but yeah, I guess, you know, why at my age of, I think, you know, practically 50 at the time did I decide to go back to grad school. And part of it was, you know, for the reason a lot of people go back to grad school. I had just been hired in a tenure track teaching position at Hofstra University, where I'd been teaching as an adjunct and running their equipment room for years. And I was looking forward to grad school, but I, you know, went to conservatory for film, so I didn't really want to be in a structured program where, especially as someone who'd been a professional cinematographer for like 25 years, I didn't really want to sit in a camera class, you know, not to be a jerk about it, but I just couldn't imagine what I would get out of it. I mean, sure, I tried to get something out of it, but just having, you know, sort of a very structured film program. And also it's just like, you know, I have a BFA in film from a conservatory that's pretty well known. You know, maybe I should do something else in the arts. So I was actually looking for an MFA in photography. And I had looked at I'd applied to Yale, but no one gets into Yale. I mean, I had friends that went there. No one gets into Yale the first time. And I actually didn't have the time to
sort of be a legacy.
Well, there's that, but I mean, they pride themselves on not taking you the first time you apply, right? They really make you work for it. So I didn't really sort of have the time to deal with that, but I didn't really want to get into Yale. I wanted to get into, there's a program with Bard, through Bard, with the International Center for Photography, the ICP, which if you've been there, it's like the Church of Photography. I mean, I felt like Liz Lemon, I went in there for the interview and I looked around and I was just like, I want to go to here. You know, there was just something really just wonderful about that. And photography was my first love. So I had my interview and it was going really well. And then the time came in, I guess I didn't read the fine print. So they were like, you know, well, you have to be here full time, you know, 5 days a week for 2 years, including summers. And I was just like, well, I can give you three maybe if I talk to my chair about, you know, scheduling. But, you know, 5 days wasn't going to be possible. And then everyone was just very sad in the room. Where else kind of everyone was sort of sad.
Because it went so well.
Because I wanted to be there. I think they wanted me to be there. And, you know, and it was just kind of sad. And then and I got in, you know, so I got in, but I couldn't go. So I had to write that letter.
That is frustrating.
It's better than getting the letter that says you aren't. So
on some level, would it have been easier just to have been denied, because then at least...
Well, it was denied by Yale, so at least I could put those two side by side and be like, Yale didn't want me, the ICP did, you know? So that was, I had a friend who went to AFI who, you know, he's also a photographer and he's a filmmaker and a cinematographer, and we work together and keep in touch. And he said, well, you know, you got in, that's kind of like going there.
You what?
He said, you got in, so that's kind of like going there. And I'm like,
okay. I understand, but I can, it's almost... Not quite, but almost as painful as getting denied.
Maybe more so. I remember leaving that interview.
Because you can't go. And it's like you feel, and then you could have, while people are going, that you're supposed to be there. And you're feeling like, I'm supposed to be there and I'm not. I think that's really difficult.
It was hard, and it was a strange thing to be walking away from there. I remember like stopping at the MoMA gift shop and buying a little present for myself, and then going to a friend's house who's you know, documentary I'd been working on, who wanted me to watch a sort of last cut before it went off to festival. And part of me was feeling sorry for myself. Part of me felt like a selfish asshole for wanting to go into a program that deep with a kid and a wife and a life and all that kind of stuff. So I just sort of get myself out of that. And I'd applied to BCFA, and I'd spoken to Stephen, who was the director at the time. We were on the phone for about 2 hours, and I'd applied to, I think, City College, which hadn't gotten back to me, and I applied to the Fear Scene School, but I actually pulled my application because I couldn't imagine humping out to the Navy Yards for 3 years. If I lived in Brooklyn, it might have been easier. And I have former students that have gone there. I have a colleague that teaches there, but I don't know. So I think part of me was looking for something less mainstreamish, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a bunch of experimental work that I'd wanted to play around with, whereas, you know, some of my professional work is experimental, but there was some personal stuff I wanted to sort of maybe play around with. And I think it just timed out well for VCFA. After about 2 days of just sort of looking around at the students there, looking at some of the work, I realized that it was a very special place, and to the point where I'm like, I pulled Steve. I'm like, I don't think you guys realize what a special thing you have going here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. Antigone was a film that had been batting around in my head after my mom had passed away, and it was just about the notion of, it was sort of about the notion of grief, and that you never, the stages of grief aren't linear, right? I don't think any time is linear, but the stages of grief certainly aren't linear, and that you could work your way through those stages, but all it takes is a smell or a sound or something to just put you right back to that day, right back to the day it happened. And, I'd had some vague notions about watching the light move through my apartment. And there was an early version of it that was just answering machine messages and empty rooms with light moving through them, which is a different film. I think it's a very austere film, and I think it could be, it would have been a film in and of itself, but... You know, as she was battling the illness, I just knew there were these moments. I didn't know I was making a film, by the way, but there are these moments that I knew I had to capture.
Hi, George. This is Mom. Happy Father's Day, honey. I hope everything is fine. And give a kiss to Petey and enjoy your happy Father's Day, okay? Love you. Bye-bye.
This is weird reading your obituary before you're dead. The world was saddened today by the passing of Antoinette Tony Nicholas. Tony was a resident of Arlington, Texas for the past 29 years. She joins her husband, Peter Nicholas, who went on before her in the year 2000. I had a little camera with me, and I just shot us going to see the Christmas tree, and we went out, she wanted to go to Ellis Island to see where our family had come from Greece, so we went out to visit there. That was a nice day, and just, my mother was a, strong Greek woman, so she had this very clear agenda of things she wanted to get done before she passed away. And part of me felt like I needed to, at least for my own memory, I guess, because memory sort of fades as you get older, to just sort of document those things. And I'd written my father's obituary, so she had asked me to write her obituary, and it was about a week before, she's in her deathbed, it was about the week before she died. And she, at that moment, she was just like, I want you to write my obituary, like, right now. And she wasn't a woman you could say no to that much. So, I remember at the time just saying, okay, well, you want me to do this, I'm going to film it. And she just said, I don't care. She didn't really, just sort of shrugged it off. So I set a camera up and I filmed it. And I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I just knew it was kind of an important thing and I needed to have it. So until I started making the film, I hadn't watched that footage. There was things I'd completely forgotten about it. And I have to say that if I wasn't at that program, I wouldn't have made the film. It was too painful. I would have walked away.
Mm-hmm.
Like one day into trying to cut it together, I would have just said, no, this is too heavy. This is too much.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Makes sense. She comes across as a really intelligent woman and a real force. I had the feeling that it's not blatant, but you just pick up on certain subtle things that she says, and you just have I had that moment where I said, this is a really just a naturally intelligent person.
She was the oldest of four, you know, first generation immigrant, you know, she'd had her own business for a long time.
She navigated,
you know, a lot of stuff. It's funny. I have a friend, an actor friend who was, his mother had passed away sort of in between, I guess. So I was in London with the other film recently, and I hadn't seen him. He'd done a film. He'd been in a short film Gabriel and I had made that had done really well. You know, played like 30 festivals or something. Phenomenal actor, and we became friends, you know, in the making of it. So I remember when his mom was sick, and I had sent him sort of a copy of it, you know, sort of afterwards, and he hadn't seen it yet. And he came to see the animated film when I was in London, and I hadn't seen it. We'd worked on a film together in Scotland. He'd brought me on to this really cool film that hadn't gone anywhere in Scotland. But, you know, we'd kept in touch. And I sent him the film. He finally watched it. And then, you know, we just had this like exchange afterwards. And his mother was from the Sudan. And, you know, it was very, we both come from, you know, people who like to drink coffee in tiny cups and eat meat on a stick. So culturally very similar. And, you know, we just had this riff back and forth about, you know, not only the sort of process that both of our mothers went through dying of cancer, but also just who they were as people, you know. And there, the similarities were, you know, it was sort of, I said, you know, I know that my mother would have, you know, killed for me. You know what I mean? Like, she was that kind of mother. She would have killed someone for me. And then we were both sort of like, yeah. And then, you know, we would have had to have buried the body in the backyard. And then, of course, both of us would have criticized how deep we buried it, or it was too close to the roses.
Yeah. It would have been like the first 30 minutes of Goodfellas.
It pretty much, yeah. So she was an amazing person. And she was an amazing person, and it was, you know, originally I was going to contrast the difference between her death and my father's death. They died in the same room, you know, 15 years apart under hospice care. But as I started to make it, it became very clear that it was her film. I'd like to say it was cathartic. I'm not at that point yet, honestly.
Yeah.
And it's been a couple of years, but I know that people have seen it, have appreciated that, you know, I guess knowing they're not alone in that, there's a lot of, a lot of things in that film that are just sort of very universal, I think.
But did you have some level of closure?
There was no, you know, that's the funny thing. I had a very good relationship with both my parents. So, you know, we're Mediterranean. So we kiss and, you know, we would fight and we would, you know, but they knew, you know.
But it's out there. It's all out there. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no holding back. Like, they knew I loved them. I knew they loved them. We said it. You know, there was no like, oh, I think my kid loves me because they show. You know, it was just like, no, every phone call ended with I love you, and we meant it. So there was nothing. I didn't feel like in the case of either parent, there was any unfinished business to attend to. You know, there was no.
I guess, that's the way closure is more often referred to or used in that context of where you might have a complex relationship, as most kids have with their parents. But I guess I meant more just losing them. You know, and saying goodbye, feeling like they, you know, well, I guess saying I love you and they know that is part of the closure. But even, you know, there might be other things like just, you know, knowing that you'll be okay and, you know, maybe as simple as that.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. There was some, with my father's death was quite different. There was some real metaphysical stuff that happened after his death, you know, so like very, you know, he, on my 33rd birthday, he visited me in a dream. Maybe it was a dream. It was one of those things. And I didn't quite have that with my mom.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about it was just slogging through all this footage. And I realized that, we had all these home movies. There's all this 8mm home movie footage in it. And, you know, she had sort of tasked me with, you know, given what I do for a living, she's like, well, we've got all these home movies and I haven't seen them. You know, is there any way you can transfer them? So I'd rigged up a system that I could, you know, not a super high quality transfer, but I'd rigged up a system where I could, you know, take the films back from Texas where she was living, you know, I'd go for the holidays and I'd come back with, you know, a bunch of reels and I'd transfer them and put them on DVD or whatever. And then it's like most things your parents ask you to do, it sort of gets backburnered with the rest of life and everything. So that last set, I realized that, you know, that the end was upon us, essentially, and I hadn't really, you know, I transferred them, but I hadn't really done anything with them. So, you know, I came down there with a laptop with the films, and there she is watching. And what I realized, which is weird as a filmmaker and maybe weird as a human being, was that I was literally flashing her life before her eyes, right? Here she was, you know, a week from leaving this earth, and she was watching, you know, she and I when I was two in the front, you know, in the backyard of our house in Pittsburgh. And at that moment, I took my phone out and just filmed it because I knew that was a weird, important thing. And that actually, you know, ultimately made it into the film that I didn't know I was making at the time. I think as a filmmaker, though, I think sometimes you're always making a film, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say guess that's part of it. I think some part of you subconsciously or maybe somewhere in the nether regions of consciousness and unconsciousness knew that there was a story here that would need to be told for yourself or for the public.
Sure, whether or not it was shared, absolutely. And I think that was, I mean, also, you know, there's some footage in there from when I was, you know, a film student. And mm-hmm. you know, when you're a film student, everything is important and everything needs to be filmed. So there's a ridiculous amount of Hi-8 footage that I had to slog through of, you know, what every time I would go home for the holidays and shoot stuff, you know, the first time my wife came to Christmas, that kind of thing. So
mm-hmm. I know that you thank, I think, in both of your shorts, because we also mentioned the second short, Smoke and Suds, that which you animated. So you're you really are a Renaissance guy when it comes to this stuff. I mean,
both of them, it was just sort of like, part of it was the fun of going back to a DIY thing. Part of it was like, I don't have the money to make, you know, it's like, I don't have the money to hire a crew.
Right? Yeah.
I would, you know, part of me was thinking about, that's a story. That's a true story that the animated film might as well be a documentary. And I've told that story.
Yeah.
Like a 100 times. Like I've told that story on stage instead of doing stand up, right? So and it's kind of like a one punchline joke, really. But it's my favorite anecdote of like living in New York during that time because I was there in a very special time, and of course when you're somewhere in a very special time, you don't realize the special time. It's just the time you're there, right? But it just seemed to me that would be a good thing. It's a funny story, and I thought that would be a good thing to do after, you know, having made the film about my mom, which was very emotionally taxing. That said, you know, the naive part of me was just like, well, I'll animate it because it's, you know, I'm a huge fan of animation and I'm a huge fan of, you know, stuff like Dr. Katz or home movies or, you know, that type of animation. So, and I've taught animation and I know how hard it is to animate, but the technology has kind of come a long way. So like an idiot, I thought, well, how hard could this be? And so I did it myself just because, you know, I foolishly thought, well, it's just me and a computer. And I learned a lot, and it was fun to do. And I sort of think I might, you know, maybe animate the next film. But
you should. You're really good at it. And
fun. I just didn't know it would be 12 minutes long. You know,
it's never, great. No, but I think any it did. Is it out there? Has it been at festivals?
Yeah, that one just,
must have been successful.
It just played at Raindance in London.
I think the festivals really picked it up. It played
at the Main International, and it was in an animation block, and they didn't have an animation block until they accepted my film. I just applied it.
They created one around your film.
They did, but the programmer had grown up. It's funny. It's funny how you never know how people are going to react to your film.
No.
Right? So the programmer at Main, who was lovely, when I got up there for the second screening, because I missed the first screening because it was another film, but when I got up there, she had told me, like, we didn't have an animation block until I got your film. She had lived in the East Village in the 70s, when it was even more exciting than living in Hell's Kitchen in the 80s.
It's not a contest. Okay, let's just move on.
Well, the funny thing about it is that she it so resonated with her experience, I guess, in living in New York in that time that, you know, in the program it actually said Two Punks in the East Village. So she sort of projected her own life onto it.
Sure.
Which I'm fine with, you know, which I, you know, people should do that. But they were quite lovely. So it's just weird. You know, the animation's not that good. So I've applied to animation festivals where you're seeing this like complete, I think the look of it suits the film. I mean, it was hard finding the aesthetic, but I wanted it to look like...
Yeah, and it's funny.
If you're walking around and you found a zine, like a punk rock zine on the ground, and you picked it up, my movie would be in there, right? That was sort of the aesthetic.
Yo, you smoke pot?
Yeah.
Good, because I'm going to roll a big fatty.
Awesome.
But it's not, you know, I've seen some tremendously beautiful animation, and that's not one of them. But I think a tremendously beautiful animation wouldn't have suited the story. So it's interesting to see, you know, who sort of picked that up. And Rain Dance took it. And the first film I'd ever made, I'd applied to Rain Dance, probably as a response to not wanting to apply to Sundance. I think I applied to Rain Dance and I applied to Slam Dance because I'd sort of already rejected Sundance at that point. just from being a punk rock and basically being like, well, this is, you know.
Right.
You know, for all the things that Sundance, I guess, became eventually. But and I didn't get into Rain Dance with that film. But so, you know, 20 years later or something, getting into Rain Dance finally, was just like, yes!
Dream realized.
A minor victory, yeah.
Well, I was living in Brooklyn in Carroll Gardens during that time, but I almost got mugged, I'm sure, once or twice in Hell's Kitchen. And
it was still a bit dicey. It was, I would say, a little bit dicey then.
I was afraid to go to Fort Greene. Now you can't afford to go. When you go to Fort Greene, you know, when you pass the Apple Store and the arena,
New York has become. I have friends in Bushwick. I would have never gone to Bushwick.
Could you have ever imagined that Bushwick would have been a hipster neighborhood? I mean, I
couldn't even believe when Williamsburg was hip.
I know, it was such a dump. It was such an industrial, totally ugly dump. And then, you know, yeah. So I think we're roughly the same age, perhaps.
I mean, I should have known. I watched that happen in Dallas, like when I lived.
Oh yeah,
I had a very brief time of living in the DFW area, and well, the funny thing about that was like, so in New York, that kind of thing happens over the course of like 20 years. Like when I lived in Hell's Kitchen, I was doing theater almost completely.
Oh right,
and I remember doing stuff at the Perry Street Theater. I was working for New York Theater Workshop, and they were running shows at the Perry Street. So. You know, I would do my day job and I would go down to the Perry Street and I would, you know, before call time, I would go to Rivoli Pizza right above the Village Vanguard and I'd have like a calzone and, you know, a little glass of wine. And there's this stunning woman there, probably in her like 70s, and she sort of invited me over to eat with her. So we were chatting and she'd been a Revlon model in the 50s, you know, and we were just talking about how, you know, she'd been there forever. And she was talking about how the neighborhood changed. And she said, the joke is, are there any artists left in Greenwich Village? Yes, but they're all married to dentists, you know. So she had seen it kind of gentrify. And I watched that happen very quickly in Dallas. There was an area called Deep Ellum. It was a very famous area called Deep Ellum that had a really amazing punk rock scene for like 4 years. And then it just, you know, it just changed very quickly.
You know what my favorite line in Suds and Smoke and Suds is? Can you guess? It's meta.
No, I don't know. Which...
Your clue is that it's meta, but maybe you haven't seen it in a while. It's when you said where they're eating nachos and how they cooked more, but you just didn't feel like animating it.
Oh, sure. Which is true. She made a lovely, lovely dinner.
Because you're narrating
Because I'm narrating it.
You're doing the voiceover.
Listen to the first voiceover of that sounded like... Originally, it was going to be animation like the beginning of it, right? That's all very, very 2D hand-drawn animation. And again, I was at VCFA, and I had some really wonderful advisors there. So my advisor, Michelle, who admittedly...
We're going to get to Michelle, don't worry.
Yeah, admittedly said, I know, you know, basically, I know fuck all of... I know nothing about animation, right? So he had no idea, like, how much labor and stuff it took. But I remember him saying to me, I just really want to, you know, when I see the characters, I just really want to be in there with the characters. And I was sort of creating the puppets for the characters, but I hadn't brought them to life yet, right? So I just had the... You know, I had the first stuff, and I had this like very well constructed voiceover that was sort of the stand up, you know, bit that I'd done about that story, and sort of expanded into the sort of painting, you know, a picture of New York at the time. And I temp tracked it. I just sort of temp tracked some music underneath it, and sort of turned it in. But I played it for other people, and it sounds like a This American Life piece. You know, it's a standalone sort of radio piece. And then, yes, as soon as I saw, you know, the puppets come to life, I was just like, oh God, he's right. You know, and then I knew it was going to be a different thing. I knew it was going to be work. But the first time I saw them sort of interact with each other.
Right. It's interesting. Like, oh, yeah. Pretty amazing how Negroponte, Michelle Negroponte, who you're talking about, was able to see that.
He's
just a very keen guy.
Phenomenal, because he sort of like both of my projects sort of went past their due date. Essentially, I wasn't going to be. It's sort of a problem with me. I'm a Virgo, so I wasn't going to just turn them in as work. Right? I was going to turn in what I needed to turn in, but I was going to keep working on them. So they both sort of went over slightly into the next semester. So he got to sort of, you know, deal with the tail end of mm-hmm. Antigone and sort of the beginnings of. You know, the beginnings of Smoke and Suds, which is frustrating for both of us, I think. But there was just some really sound, you know, advice in there. And I adore his filmmaking.
So yes.
And the odd thing was I had a student who brought in a bunch of his mother's 16mm stuff from when she was at NYU and wanted me to transfer it and help him sort of, you know, edit together. He's going to give it to her as like a Thanksgiving present or something. And, when I started studying with Michelle, I was just like, wait, Negroponte, that name rings a bell. And I went back to my office, you know, when I got back from, my residency, and there was a piece of maybe 100 feet of film with a head leader on it. And it had his name on the head leader. And I realized that she was, you know, his student.
That's funny.
And she was at NYU at the same time I was at Purchase. So the older I get, the smaller the world gets.
Like, it's true. That's why I bring him up, or you brought him up, but I'm bringing it around to him because there's a community of people around this podcast that I keep coming back on. And
sure.
Michelle's done it like three times, but we're meeting, like we've been emailing because he showed me something new he made, and maybe you've seen it.
Was it his last film about the guy? Well, I mean, about the guy, but the painter, the sort of outside artist.
Yes.
Oh, that was amazing.
Yeah.
The green screen stuff, and that was.
But
incredible.
He's frustrated, so he because of the. I don't want to talk about this on the show, but he contacted me about it, you know, a little bit of strategy talk, because you know, not that I'm a professional about it, but I talked to so many people over the years in festivals, and I'm a programmer, but I'm just sort of entrenched in all of that too. So it's sure. Like I'm able to kind of give some feedback, maybe help him put things in perspective, what have you. He's such a talented storyteller, but he's not mainstream, the stuff he's making. Right. So, but there's,
I don't
a place
even know what that
it.
Means anymore.
There's, so, it's I mean? Kind of true, but I just guess, I mean, you know, there is like the Hollywood movie. Then there is the independent film that you catch at certain festivals. You named a couple of them, but that just sort of where you expect to see a certain type of film that, you know, feels like a comfortable shoe, you know.
Sure.
And he doesn't make comfortable shoes. I mean, you know,
no.
That's my feeling about it, you know, and that's why, I mean,
he makes Steve Martin's The Cruel Shoes in the best way.
Cruel Shoes, that's right. But I went up to the Vermont College a couple of years ago. It's probably a few during one of their
one of the residencies. It's like a week intensive in the spring
where they have their annual week or something, right, where everybody comes up and does workshops and watches the films. And yeah,
in the fall.
Yeah,
so that you get, I think, like five of them, I guess, when you're a student there.
I came to a spring one, and I have, a number of people who I know through the years that are on the faculty up there, and then they also started to, this was a result already of the fact that Vermont College was doing some sponsoring of some of my shows.
Do you remember who was up there that week?
Sure, Till, Josephine.
Sure, so the usual cast of characters.
Well,
do you remember any of the visiting filmmakers?
But I did an episode, hold on, I'll tell you, I did a whole episode up when I was up there. Laura, Jake Mahaffey.
Oh, so when Jake was there, okay.
Yeah.
So he was only there for one semester, so that had to be the first semester I was there.
Right, yeah. And so
Jake
came
on. Jake was amazing.
Malik Vital. Did you know Malik?
Yeah, sure. Malik broke my glasses in a one-on-one basketball match that I should not have challenged him to.
Yeah. Oh, well, sorry about that. Also, like, Terrence was up there doing a workshop or whatever.
I think Terrence was there my first... my friend Gabe has a total man crush on him because of his first film. My friend Gabriel, who I make films
with. The actor
with.
You were talking about?
No, no, the director. In fact, when I told him that, he sort of mentioned his name in passing, I'm like, oh, he's one of our faculty members. And he was just like, wait, can I meet him? And I'm like, I don't know. I think he's, you know... it's funny because he was there. It was like a hit and run that semester. He came in and like showed something, and he was there for a day, and he had to go back because he had so much stuff going on.
Right, yeah. I would run into him more frequently. My kid for a while was taking jiu-jitsu in Brooklyn. You know, he was in a kid's class, but right afterwards they'd have an adult class, and Terrence was always in the next class.
So funny.
I'd run into him like once a month at this place.
Is he still doing it, your son?
No.
Oh, how old is he?
My son turns 15 in a couple of weeks.
Oh my God, our sons are exactly the same age.
Oh, great, yeah.
Yeah, so well, I think we're just closing. Turned 15 like last week. So oh, I was born in 67.
How many kids do you have?
Just one, just the one.
One boy, me too.
One boy.
Yeah, I'm a couple
second
years
one
older.
Didn't work out.
What's that?
Second one didn't work out, didn't happen. There's almost a second one. But
oh, I see. Yeah. Well, I broke up with my wife, so this... My second.
So if you'd had a second, it would have been with someone else.
Yeah, I was kind of, and then I felt it was somebody, you know, after that who just wasn't going to have children. So I had to reconcile that, but I loved her and, sure. You know, it's interesting. It was a real thing, you know, it was a real question. Like, you know,
it's funny because when you're young, like, you know, you hear people say that I never want to have kids. And I had a friend like that who I was like best man at her wedding. We were in a band together. And she was sort of adamantly not having kids. And she's, you know, she's my age. She's not having kids. And she's reached beyond the point of having kids. And she's cool with that.
Well, biologically.
Yeah. I mean, but past the biologics. I mean, although
you could rent them, right? Or something, right? Lease them?
Yeah. There's all sorts of stuff you can get now.
Yeah.
But yeah. So yeah, my son has been doing Taekwondo since he was like four.
Oh, wow.
It's ridiculous. So
Taekwondo is, yeah, it's a very different, right?
Yeah, and he studies with, like, you know, his classes, his school, I think, just opened when he was, like, four. So it was one of those, like, oh, something to do in the summer kind of things.
Yeah.
And he took to it. It was one of those strange things where he just really, really took to it. So he just got his third dan, like, you know, a couple months ago. He's, like, a third-degree black belt, and he's 15. It's ridiculous. And he teaches and stuff. And it's just...
Well, he'll quit. It's great with the confidence, right?
The funny thing about all that stuff is when you watch them, you know, you watch them get to that point where they're just sort of flailing all over the place. And then there's like a one magic moment where they're all in sync, you know, and that's just sort of like these like little, I mean, for me, fatherhood is just like this whole series of blurs, you know, and probably for you as well. You just sort of, he's taller than my wife now. He's, you know, he looks like me. It's crazy. Yeah. It's all
he's
a blur.
Like five.
It's all just a giant, yeah. Giant blur.
I'm just like, I look at my kid and he's getting to that point. He's going to be like, he's in his 5'3" or 5'4". It's crazy. I just like, what happened? You were such a pipsqueak.
Well, you keep feeding.
Yeah, I know. It's what...
People ask me, like, how do you get to feed him? Like, we kept feeding him and he just kept growing.
He just feeds himself a lot of the time too. You know?
Well, now, yeah. But it's like, ridiculous how much food he goes through. Yeah.
He's pretty independent.
It's just that one of like, you know, can you go to Cozy? I'm like, yeah, what do you want? He's like, I want two pizzas and two sandwiches. I'm like, well, you're not going to eat both of those. And yeah. He ate both of those. Yeah.
My son will go like all day without eating a thing, and then he'll just eat like everything in the evening.
Sure.
You know, like he'll just all of a sudden get hungry and then just be ravenous. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, same. Yeah. And my son's like a rabid vegan. So it's like, that changes the whole, which I'm fine
it really
with.
Does.
Because he's not annoying about it, which is cool. I mean. I have friends that are vegans that are annoying.
I think
we've reached a point in like human evolution where people can be vegans and not. Yeah, I think CrossFit has taken over where, you know, the annoying thing that veganism used to be. You know, I think we've reached other things that people can be
vegans
annoying
become
about.
More, yeah, I think commonplace. And although I was annoyed today because I was listening to a podcast with Moby, and he was talking about
how
he was always what?
Don't get me started on Moby. I know Moby.
Okay, but he was in a. Apparently, this is years ago. He was saying that he. Was on a tour bus and, you know, it was like after, I guess, Porcelain or whatever. Play. And anyway, he was saying that maybe it was before that, but he was on a bus. He got off, they were in Austin, Texas, and he got off the bus. He was very hungry and he walked around the corner and he went into a Whole Foods for the first time. And he had never seen one before. And he went in there and was able to get all the vegan stuff. And so afterwards, he was so happy. Felt so good. He called up his financial guy, whatever, and he said,
right.
You know, can you look to see if this company's public? And this guy went in and he said, yeah, it just recently became public. And he goes, can you buy some shares of that? So basically, probably Moby could have retired because he just invested well in Whole Foods.
On Whole Foods.
Years
yeah.
and years ago. So, but it's annoying because it's like it's a vegan success, you know, just so out of proportion with what
my, my friend Paul, who I went to purchase with, he and Moby grew up together, and they're, as he likes to put it, frenemies. So Moby was in Paul's first feature, which was basically it's a cool little film. It's basically like Clerks set in a sex shop on Christmas Eve. It's called Alien Sex Party. They wanted to call it porno, but Walmart would refuse to call, you know, places like Walmart refused to distribute a film that was called porno. And it's so self-aware of what it is. They actually go to, the two main characters go to a convenience store, and Brian O'Halloran has like a cameo playing Dante, essentially, in it. So they're very keen about knowing what they were. And I guess during the making of that, you know, Moby had put some money into it. And during the making of that, there's a, you know, Moby played like sort of this crazy recurring character that would come in. Mm-hmm. And there's one shot where he comes in, he's got like five dildos on his head, right? And then Paul gets a phone call or a letter from Moby's people saying, we don't want our client depicted like that. And he's like, well, I just raised money based on that footage. So, you know, it's staying in the film, essentially. So the whole thing sort of culminated in Paul putting Moby's soul for sale on eBay. And I remember, I don't know, I think I was coming back from Newport Beach Film Festival with the first film I did with Gabe, but I was on a plane and I remember reading, like, you know, the sort of back of time or something, that had happened. And I just started giggling because I knew who it was who put the soul for sale. And a friend of his bought it. So I remember, like, you know, sort of interacting with Moby, you know, when I was an undergraduate, and I was an inveterate smoker and drinker, and he was none of those things. And he was actually in Paul's senior film. So we had two cars that drove up to, we did these exterior scenes on the sand dunes of Provincetown. This is the nearest thing we could find to sort of the desert, I guess. And it was just a very arty black and white film that Paul did for his senior film. It's actually an extra in that, in the DVD of the film they made together. But Moby was in it, and Moby did the soundtrack for it. He then sold the soundtrack to, he ended up using the same soundtrack for Heat. So he sold that to Michael Mann. So part of their whole wranglings was that Paul got to retain the rights to the soundtrack for
really?
His film.
Wow, yeah. That's a pretty amazing.
So there's some inside dirt. I don't know if I violated anyone's legal stuff, but yeah, so Moby. Oh, Moby. Moby.
Moby, Moby, Moby. What Moby, do we Moby. Do with you, for God's sake?
He's sort of mellowed over time. I think he drinks beer now, so that's a plus. Yeah, we'll get him dropping acid anytime.
Yeah, no, but he was always vegan and sober. That was the thing he was known for, and that he would play in these raves and clubs where everybody was taking everything, and he was straight, and he was observing this, and it must have been very odd. Must have been very odd.
I imagine it's kind of like going to the zoo, I guess. But I don't know, I remember like going. I was sort of half dating this girl, and she took me to this party, some big thing in Manhattan, and there were all these DJs, you know, and I remember thinking at the time, as a musician, I remember thinking at the time, there is nothing more boring than watching like techno player, you know, people perform music, you know, and that was, I think that was, you know, there were still turntables involved then, so there was still some motion. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just some guy like hitting a button or something, but Moby was there, and I was just like, oh shit, Moby's here. So, and my friend Paul was doing like film loops for him at the time and playing backup, like Paul toured with him and stuff. So, you know, went over and said hey to them, and it was kind of funny, but you know, it was weird because there was a guy that was doing lights for them, I guess, that I had worked with, and he might be, if I expanded Smoke and Suds, he would be the sort of chapter two in that animation. This guy Scotto. Mm-hmm. And we worked at a lighting rental house together. We lived across the street from each other on 45th Street. His apartment was a more derelict than mine. It was a couple floors up, and the floors were so uneven that we would be drinking, and you know, one of our, you know, empty bottles would fall over and it'd start rolling down. You know, it's one of those like cold water flats with a bathtub in, you know, in the kitchen. And Scotto had come up, I think he was younger than I was, and I was probably 21. Scotto was probably 18 or something. He'd come up from Baltimore wanting to be a promoter and a club promoter, like to promote parties and stuff. And I didn't even know that was a thing. I mean, that was like, so the nightclub scene was so not my world. Mm-hmm. And there was this one week where he took me to every nightclub in town, like every hot nightclub in town. We were both broke, poor roadies. You know, we had no money. So we were going to like an MTV fashion party at MK, and we were in, you know, and it was the same thing at every club. We'd go to the front. He would kiss the doorman. I didn't realize he was gay at the time, as far as I was concerned. Like, everyone was at least bi because it was, you know, theater. And we'd kiss the doorman. We'd go in. And we're in there, and we couldn't, like, literally couldn't afford to buy drinks, you know. And so we went to, you know, like, for just a 1 week span, maybe 2 weeks, I went to every nightclub, every hot, the hottest nightclubs in New York at the time. And yeah, with Scotto, and one of them, and I didn't know who any of these people were at the time, but in one of them, Michael Alig was trying to drag him into the bathroom to have sex with him. And he was just like, you know, kind of get away from me, whatever. And, you know, of course, Michael Alig was one of the, like, I'd met all those club kids, like that whole scene, right? And found them, you know, especially as a punk, found them completely annoying. But they all, you know, became, you know, they killed a guy. It was, the whole thing was like, there's a whole to-do. And then, you know, Scott actually lived, you know, realized his dream and was traveling around the world as a DJ and throwing parties and stuff. But it's through him, and this is the thing that would probably make it into that film, it's through him, I think it's called The Red Zone. And I met all these drag queens, and he was introducing me, and he's like, oh, this is my friend George, and this is, you know, this is RuPaul. And RuPaul wasn't RuPaul yet. And I remember, like, an idiot meeting RuPaul and sort of putting my hand out and looking up. RuPaul and I are the same height, but, you know, he wore very big heels. I just remember saying, wow, how tall are you? You know, it's the stupidest question in the world to ask.
Right. How's the weather up there?
How's the weather?
Exactly. That might have been dumber, but then...
That would have been dumber. Because I was just kind of like actual curious, you know, informational thing. Yeah. And I can remember to this day, and this would make an animation, RuPaul looked down at me and said, well, compared to the Twin Towers, I'm only this big, you know, and I just laughed. And that was, yeah, that was just a very strange, strange week.
I remember in the mid... Might have been the mid-80s, but I was at a club, and I was at some event with my family. So there must have been some film thing going on there, because my father was in publishing, and he would get invited to lots of these parties, you know, after films. And we were in some club, and everybody was ready. Then we heard that some performer was going to be there at this club named Madonna, you know, and
like,
you
should
wait around. Would you want to wait around for her to show up? And I'm like, Madonna? No, I mean, I'm not going to stay.
Yeah, who's that?
Like,
what is that?
I think her first album maybe was just Breaking or something. Holiday was on, I don't even know if it was on the radio or it was just, but I remember that, I mean, you would have to remember that if somebody named Madonna was going to be coming to this club, that, and then a few months later, that's all, the only name you hear for the next three,
right,
4 years.
Right, because you never know. You're just like, who's that? I don't know.
You
know?
Yeah, but you remember it. Oh, I should have stuck around. I would have had, like, you know, been in this little club with her just right there, and I would have seen her at the very beginning.
I think of all the things I've missed.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, is there a point where you're going to post these two shorts so people can see them? They're so good. Antigone is the one about your mom who, in her final days when she was in hospice, and then, which is a very reductive way of describing it. And then also your animated comedy. I'm going to call it a comedy. It's very funny. Which is called...
It's comedy. It's still kind of sad at the end. I think when I was at VCFA, I found my voice, and I think my voice is... There's always some loss involved, and I'm okay with that.
So that's a great ad for VCFA right now. Go to the Vermont College of Fine Arts Film Program and find your voice as a filmmaker.
Find your voice, yeah. I mean, I did, and that was... I thought I had it figured out before I went there. Like, so before I went to VCFA, I thought, okay, I'm shooting films. I'm generally... choosing the films that I shoot, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not just having to take anything. I mean, I think I took more jobs than I would have normally not turned down when I had a kid. I think that changes things. But I was, you know, for narrative films, I was just very much cherry picking the stuff I wanted to do. I you know, you're as respected on set as the director is, as the DP, and, you know, I have a sense of sort of authorship about my work. You've seen my work. It's very, you know, visual or whatever, as one would hope it would be. But I'm a very collaborative DP, so I would shoot feature film or dramatic short or whatever. And, you know, once we wrapped, I'd just walk away. And then, you know, I'd come back for the final color correct, and that was it. And I was okay with that, you know, and until I started doing my own work. And then I sort of felt like I'd been hiding from that, you know. I think I realized that I'd been hiding from that. So, you know, I'm going back to shooting stuff, but I think I'll keep making films because I think there's a lot of stories there. And I think that that they're worth telling. So both of those films are sort of reaching the end of their festival run. So mm-hmm. I'm probably going to put Antigone up on my Facebook and also my Instagram for Mother's Day. I think I'll put that up for Mother's Day.
That's a good.
I think there's real distribution. I don't think there's any potential for distribution, at least in that one.
I think it's safe to put it. Also, companies are not as, if this is what you're talking about, they're not, like film festivals, I noticed, don't care as much when a short's been. If you like just stuck up your short on YouTube, for instance, festivals will still take your short, as opposed to like a feature, if they find out was on YouTube for a year, that would affect that would obviously affect their decision.
I mean, they both had their world premieres and stuff, so there's no...
Right.
Now I'm getting, sort of like the Smoke and Suds particularly, I'm getting festivals that sort of, I guess, heard about it at Rain Dance and are sort of asking me to participate in their film festival. So I don't think they'll mind if I throw it up, somewhere, which I'll do. So definitely, Sigmalian, I guess, is my Instagram handle. So Antigone will be going up there. Smoke and Suds has its own Facebook group, like its own Facebook page. So I think in June I might throw that up there.
Mm-hmm.
So look for Smoke and Suds on Facebook. Smoke and Suds, I guess, on Facebook.
Smoke and Suds, that's right.
And I'll probably, neither of them are in public links right now, so we'll have to put them on Vimeo or something.
Right.
I don't know. It's like Smoke and Suds, I think. There's something about that I like. Even watching, I just watched it again recently, and I'm like, no, that's...
It's a great short. No, it's a really entertaining short. It's really good.
Rough stuff in it, but there's some... Yeah,
no, I'm also... maybe I'm a little bit subjective because I have a subjective reaction to it because I also... I'm of that particular time and generation, and one looks back at it with, sort of rose-tinted glasses in the sense that as horrible as the city was then, it was affordable at the very least.
Interesting. It's unaffordable and not very interesting.
Exactly. We sound like two old codgers now, but
I know.
Two geezers.
I have to go in a second to tell people to get out of my yard yell at children to get off
exactly.
my lawn.
And shake your fist when you say it, you know.
Oh, you can't. You can't shake your fist when you're saying get off my lawn.
Yeah.
But no, I think that it's what's weird about that film is that I somehow managed to make a 12-minute animated Jim Jarmusch film. And what's funny about that was when I was at Purchase, like we all wanted to be Jim when we grew up.
Not Hal?
No, I mean, Hal was sort of a contemporary, and I adored Hal's work. I remember when I was, when I was living in Manhattan before I even knew what Purchase was, like going to see Hal's work, with my cousin and going to see, going to the Ziegfeld and seeing like The Last Temptation of Christ, walking through picket lines of, people who didn't get the message, getting high with a stranger in the bathroom of the Ziegfeld after seeing, I think it was Ziegfeld, after seeing, what was it? It was a Woody Allen film. The Other Woman, I think.
Another
was that
woman.
The one that where he cast like...
Jenna Rollins?
David Ogden Stiers as a young mm-hmm. John Houseman.
Oh, I could see that.
That was like the best casting choice I've ever seen. I was just like, it was one of those like, gah, because nothing remember. Ruins...
It was a period one?
No, was it? That's a good question.
I don't
know. Probably if I hadn't gotten high with a stranger in a bathroom,
that's
I
don't right.
remember that. But it was a different time then, and I did that sort of thing, which is funny because I don't, it's been years. But the funny thing about that is like I was a pothead for like 1 month of my life because I wasn't really using my brain for anything.
Okay, your son might be listening to this podcast. So we've gotten, you've done your, what have you, you've made your excuses, and we know you're a pretty straight guy.
Well, people ask you, like, what are you going to tell your kid about drugs?
And
half-joking say, well, I would tell them know your dealer, no needles, basically. I think that would be the extent of it. And, don't overdo anything. I think the Native Americans had everything in moderation. Don't overdo anything.
Good advice.
I think it's foolish to assume that they're not going to try any of that stuff, so they should at least be safe with it.
I agree. Well, I appreciate this. It was great fun. And what town are you in?
I'm in Mamaroneck. I moved.
You're in Mamaroneck. That's what I thought. Yeah. I thought I read. So interesting. Yeah, but I spent a lot of time in Mamaroneck on Old Gratian Road.
On where?
It's like if you go past the, I don't know what it is. It's like the, some sort of pond at the in the little center of town there, and then you drive up. I forget what the name of the road is, but you go by. I guess where you turn off for the country club, one of the country clubs.
Sure, we're lousy with golf clubs up here.
But it's just down. It's by an offshoot of the Sound. My friend's father has a house there. I've gone there many times over the years.
Really nice houses on that side of the post.
Really, really nice house.
Amernex,
he can't sell it. That's how nice it is.
Yeah, the whole post road thing's interesting because it's basically like a checker. So all the property by the water, money, right? Mm-hmm. And then you go up the coast, and it's basically like working class town, rich town. And the people that worked in the rich towns or built the houses there, you know, would live like in Mamaroneck, or mm-hmm. you know, they would build the houses in like Larchmont. And then you get to New Rochelle, which is its own thing. So it's a very, I didn't really get the whole idea of the right and wrong side of the tracks, I guess, until I moved to this area. And I'm like, oh, I get it now.
Absolutely. It's striking.
But Westchester's weird. I moved in with my girlfriend when I was still at Purchase, and then I just never left. I guess that's what happened. Just never left. We were in the same house. It's ridiculous, actually. We should probably own a house or something, but we were in the same house that is home to me. It's my son's home. It's our home. But I think to my wife, it's the first apartment she had after college, so mm-hmm. she feels like a loser still living in it. But yeah, what can you do?
Well, if you're a student and you happen to be going to Hofstra, you can check out Jordan Nicholas's classes. And
Hofstra's, we get some good kids out of there. We've had Oscar nominees. Well, almost Oscar nominees, but yeah. It's a good program. I think that's one of those things. I stayed there for 12 years. I think I just made 15 years there, and I haven't left because of the students.
Wow.
The students are really, they just love film. Like, they love making mm-hmm. films. They're not toxic to each other.
That's great.
You know, I hire them, they hire me, it's good.
All right, well, thank you very much. This has been terrific.
Absolutely.
And we'll be in touch. I'll send you.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I'll just Dropbox my side of it.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Because it's going to be one big file, so just Dropbox it
right.
and email it to you.
Yeah. And hopefully now that our bit rates are matched up, it'll be an easy sync. Easy sync job.
Yeah, shouldn't be a problem.
Great.
I mean, I don't think you'll have any reference on this side of it, but you'll have I don't know what's going on your side of it, but you'll have, I guess, me in a lower quality version of me in your living room right now or whatever.
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah.
You're recording? Yeah. So it should be easy to lock everything up.
Yeah, yeah.
Plus, you're going to have to edit the crap out of it because, again, I veer into the weeds. It's one of those things I do. It's not hard to get me to start talking. It's very hard to get me to shut the fuck up.
This has been a pleasure. I enjoyed the. I enjoyed almost the entire time. No, it was all great. It was a lot of fun. And if you find yourself coming through, or if you want to see Michelle or something like that, let me know. And I just emailed him actually before when I saw his name kept coming up on your shorts. I emailed him because I was reminded that we're supposed to get together for coffee. He went on vacation, and then he would try to get together like a couple of weeks before, and I couldn't do it. I just was that crazy. And now
I want to see him. Like, he's probably up in Vermont right now because I think they're about to start there. He's not. Is he going up this semester?
I mean, actually, maybe.
Maybe
was,
it's next.
We
week.
Were talking
it's
about
it's around
together.
This time. So
oh, okay, it's very possible. You're right. It's right. That's right. They had their another one of the residencies because I took my son up there. This had to be at least a good 3 years ago. Well, I could have just seen since I had my site up with the telling me all the information about that episode.
Well, Jake was there. It was definitely 3 years because he was only there
three.
For one semester.
Yeah. So I took my son up there, and it was like, you know, this time of year, and I thought, oh, this is a nice long weekend. They gave us a house. I mean, it was really nice. And, you know, we had just gone through the winter here, and it was the beginning of spring, and like, you know, it is here. And we get up to Vermont. It's like
it snowed,
started
right?
snowing instantly.
Yeah, yeah.
And I felt so bad. I'm like, I'm sorry. I wanted to take up to this beautiful... It was still very beautiful in Montpelier, of course, but, you know.
Oh, it's nice, but the filmmakers get the... And I talked to Stephen about that. He was very, you know, Stephen was... I don't know if you met him, but he was great. He had this, like, gravelly, you know, gravelly voice. And he's very funny, but he just said, you know, that the writers get the best time up there. So we, you know, the writers go up there when the trees are on fire, mm-hmm. right? And we get there in the spring, or we get there in the fall, like,
and it's all
after
marsh.
All the leaves have fallen off, yeah.
Right, and it's just one wet swamp land.
Yeah, and same in the spring. In the spring we got the worst time of it. But you know,
well, that's what I meant.
That said, we spend most of our time like in, you know, down at the Savoy Theater or in
right.
rooms looking at each other's films. So that's always sort of been the way with film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a great time.
Yeah, it's. I mean, Montpelier is a strange little town, but it was kind of. I miss it. I miss it. I'll go up if I can. I'll go up next year. I've just been too. I've just been too busy teaching. So it's, you know, it always comes up. And even when I was a student there, it came up at the absolute worst times of each semester.
Right.
You know, to go. But I will make time to go up on a long weekend. I just felt bad. My band was going to play there last spring. Maybe it was last spring or maybe even in the fall. I forgot which. But my band was supposed to play. And then one member just backed out at the last minute. So I was scrambling to try to find them a backup band. I was just mortified that, because I'd asked them well ahead of time. I was just like, okay, you guys want to do this? Because they invited us up. And they're like, oh, yeah, that'd be fun. And then, you know, one backed out, and then the rest just fell. And I just like, I don't know if I'm going to be in this band anymore because you guys let me down. So, yeah. Everything worked out fine, but I just still feel bad about it, you know, because that would have been fun. But,
Fair indeed. Well, enjoy the rest of your weekend.
You as well. And it was great talking to you.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
I'm sure if we did a list of people we knew side by side, that there would be a lot of lines drawn back and
forth. Yes, there would. Absolutely. And most of them are in your credit.
In my field.
And in your credit scroll. And you know, I'm sure we do know quite a few people.
Yeah, and if you ever want to talk to Gabe about Seven Splinters, because it was a weird ride. The story of making that film might be more interesting than the film itself. The film is pretty damn interesting.
But
if you do,
sure,
just let me know.
You can connect us.
Three of us could talk or whatever.
Sure. Sounds good. That would just complicate it further. We'd get a third mic, third recording, syncing.
Oh, sure. We've done it, but it's weird.
It's a good, more challenges, the better. No, we'll sign off and I'll let you go.
My friend wants to have a fire in the backyard, which I'd be cool with, except it's been raining all day. So
it sounds like a nice evening either way. I'm just going to call it a night myself.
All right. Well, have a good night. I'm going to finish grading some stuff and eat some pasta, I think, and maybe have a fire in my backyard. And we do that. This is going to be.
It's always good when a fire in your backyard is intentional. That's all I can say.
Yes, that's always good. We live right behind the fire department, so even if it wasn't, we'd be covered, I think.
One man's fire in the backyard is another. Well, I won't go there. All right, take care. Talk to you soon.
Right. Pleasure meeting you. Bye-bye.
Same here.
Every day when I open my eyes, now it feels like a Saturday. Taken down from the shelf all the parts of myself that are packed away. It's love with the joy in my heart. Is it God by another name? Who's to say how it goes? All I know is I'm back in the world again. Like the lift of a curse, got a whole different person inside my.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Please go to iTunes and leave us a star rating and a review or whatever your podcast app that you use to listen to the show, whether it's Stitcher or Spotify, what have you. We're also, by the way, every segment goes up on YouTube, or just about every segment, plus extra stuff that doesn't even get onto the podcast. There's coverage of the Tribeca Film Festival, Montclair Film Festival, Maryland Film Festival. I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but we're supposed to go to the Greenwich International Film Festival. There'll be BAM Cinema Fest. Then we're going to have the Lighthouse International Film Festival. All this and more, that's just through the next month or so. And the Brooklyn Film Festival. We are also then going to be in the coming up after the summer. We go to the New York Film Festival, the Hamptons International Film Festival, possibly the Woodstock Festival, Doc NYC. So there's just endless amounts of... Maybe this year we'll try to go to TIFF. I don't know. We'll have to see how that turns out. I always would like to do that. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Please do get involved and engaged with Film Wax Radio. Be in touch and let us know. If you write us an email or if you leave us a review, I will read it on this very show. Take care of yourselves and the ones you love. This is Adam Sharkov, Film Wax Radio Movement Podcast. Take care.
Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads. Okay. Everything is broken.
switches, broken gates.